Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Jose State University Doctoral Program in Educational Leadership, a new professional degree program offered for leaders in education. Accepting applications at sjsu.edu/edd.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up in this morning's forum program, Noah Cowan was named executive director of the San Francisco Film Society a mere 2 months before the organization's biggest event, the San Francisco International Film Festival, which begins next week. Cowan, who comes to the organization after serving as artistic director of the Toronto International Film Festival, is the group's fourth executive director in 3 years, and we'll talk to him about this year's festival selections and his plans for San Francisco's film culture. That's up next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Noah Cowan is the fourth executive director in the past 3 years of the San Francisco Film Society, which produces the San Francisco International Film Festival, now in its 57th year. He joins us in studio for this hour. I should mention he served for 5 years at the helm of the Toronto International Film Festival before heading up the San Francisco Festival. And we welcome him to San Francisco and welcome him to our studios. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, you know, I was thinking about you being happy to be here. You had a lot more in Toronto. You had your own complex.
The Lightbox was a dream come true. I was able to do enormous amounts of curatorial activity, really bring together a lot of visual arts and film ideas that were had been bubbling away in my mind. But through that whole time, there was a couple of things lurking in the back of my mind. One of them was the ability to once again shape an institution. I ran my own business for a long time and loved that. And also on the other
hand, what was the business?
It was called Cowboy Pictures. We distributed incredibly difficult art films in New York City for about 10 years. But as you might imagine, that's a tough business to be in. So at a certain point, it had to end.
And a Canadian cowboy, too.
There you go. We exist. We got planes, too. The other thing that was always in my mind, though, was while we were going about our business promoting film and sort of championing it in different ways, the entire medium, the entire business, but, you know, all the artistic side as well was being altered. And it was being altered by a lot of people in this area. And so to actually come down here to begin some sort of a dialogue with the artists here and also with the tech companies that are changing how we're watching moving images every day in different ways is a really exciting proposition.
Yeah, you sound excited. And I was reading some of your opining on or envisioning on what you'd like to do here. And it really does sound somewhat visionary. I mean, in the sense that cinema is a part of a larger cultural conversation as opposed to, you know, the kind of red carpets, movie stars. I mean, not to say that we're not going to have premieres and those sorts of things anyway, but it seemed like you want to make it more festive, too. Wine, food, all that sort of thing, and that sounds good.
Do you like that idea? I mean, there's a lot of natural offerings that any place has, and San Francisco happens to have bountiful amounts of them, not just the food and the wine, the beautiful weather, the incredible parks. As you can tell, I've been settling in very well so far. But also this really interesting approach to culture and cultural conversation. It's even in the 5 weeks I've been here, the number of conversations I've had about collaborative activity have been incredibly inspiring.
Well, and also, you've got a lot of film festivals here. I mean, you were mentioning the tech world. There's the San Jose Film Festival now. There's a Napa Film Festival. There's, of course, the Mill Valley Film Festival all around the Bay. But this has been a long time and well-established international film festival. And yet, a lot of the film festivals seem too market-oriented. I mean, you want something somewhat different than that. You're looking to Telluride, or you're looking maybe to San Sebastian in Spain, those kinds
of
things?
Yeah, I mean, there's look, we all love movie stars. We all deal day to day with the business side of the film industry. Many of my closest friends are in the sales and distribution end of the film world. However, I think maybe the role of film festivals has shifted a little bit aggressively towards serving the sort of business masters of the medium right now. And maybe we've lost a little bit of – we're a little out of touch with what our audiences are looking for. there are a lot of options for people who want to see moving images, if you will. These days, there's beautiful long-form television for the young. There's these interactive games and machinima. The internet provides us with plenty of opportunities to see all sorts of storytelling. But film is something very particular. We actually gather in one place, and if you can actually provide some sort of extended events, some sort of way of thinking and talking about a film, which is longer than most TV shows, if you can actually provide conversation, if you can even provide the opportunity to eat something or drink something that's related to what you're watching, how exciting is that? How different is that? And if we can provide those sorts of events here in San Francisco, we maybe can be a model for some of the other festivals and other places around the world about how we want to actually experience film 20 years hence.
We're not just talking popcorn here, obviously. but when you talk about the accessibility of films, you know, LaVideo is surviving largely due to a partnership with Green Apple Books. And the accessibility of videos, video stores are dying out, especially foreign films. Remember Mick LaSalle, when he was last on, was almost lamenting the fact that, you know, just the whole vetting of foreign films and how they get selected and the accessibility of films, especially foreign films, is becoming difficult. Where do you go? You go to Netflix, which has meager selections. Thank heavens for the film festivals. I'm just talking about in the broad sense of what we might expect or hope for.
Yeah, I mean, the San Francisco has a wonderful collection of festivals. I mean, every day you can actually experience something from around the globe on screen. Very few other cities have that advantage. And the online services are coming online, are trying to figure out how to deal with global cinema, but they aren't there yet. And it is truly urgent that we actually address this problem. In the segment you had on before about Boko Haram, how do we even access the understanding of what's going on there? I mean, the easiest way to do it is probably through a film, with someone actually talking through a documentary, through a narrative feature film that actually addresses the horrors, but also the realities of day-to-day life in that part of the world.
I was looking online at videos of that guest we had on from Harvard, from the Nieman Fellow, for example, and thank heavens for that. Again, you know, just hearing her, didn't even get to a lot of the stuff that she was presenting in that particular video. But I'm just wondering about, again, what has come down in many people's minds to just the difficulty seeing the kind of movies that they want to see. For example, I had a walk with a friend over the weekend, and he was feeling wretched about the fact that he'd been in New York. He wanted to see this Rumsfeld film, this new documentary by Errol Morris.
Yep.
It's been in New York for a long time. It's not in San Francisco. Why isn't it in San Francisco? I mean, we continue to ask these questions in San Francisco. Why are films in New York not only don't make it out here, but in some instances simply come months and months later?
I mean, the vagaries of the commercial distribution industry are odd. And how those changes occur has much to do with real estate, has much to do with how distribution is sliced up, you know, around the country as anything else. Basically, it's still a business founded in the 1920s that hasn't changed very much. And, San Francisco, though, there have been some significant changes, and there are changes that need to be dealt with. And the big one is that this used to be when I was a distributor, this was the third most important market for art films in the country after New York and Los Angeles, and would often top Los Angeles. Now, I'm not sure it's even in the top five. So we need to figure out ways to get people excited about films again.
However, less culturally oriented people being able to afford living in San Francisco.
Maybe. Well, but it's interesting. I mean, I think part of it is that this is technology forward, this city, and so people have found other avenues for actually getting to these films, to finding this content. And so San Francisco is probably a predictor for the rest of the country and how theaters are going to go, which is sad to me because, for me, the best place to see a film is in a beautiful cinema.
There was a year-round venue attempt by Graham Leggett when he was your predecessor, who unfortunately passed away. You're talking about Japantown as a place. Are you thinking year-round?
We need to have a year-round presence for the San Francisco Film Society, and I think there are a lot of different ways for us to do that. I mean, we're already very much within the filmmaking community, and that's spilling out in the sort of consumer mind as well through the filmmaking that we do. I mean, we are engaged in funding some of the best films of any given year of the last few, films like Beasts of the Southern Wild and Fruitvale Station, six films that were in Sundance this year. But that being said, there is something about like being out there and actually showing films and providing those opportunities to give context to not only the world of cinema but actually the world around us. So we're looking at lots of different options. Would we actually take on the lease of a big cinema tomorrow? Probably not. But are we looking at different kinds of partnerships so that we can actually have homes If not a single home, then multiple homes throughout the city. That's a possibility.
I would think Lucasfilm, but also Pixar, yeah.
Well, we love those guys. I mean, I think we've already been working quietly with both Lucas and Pixar, but especially with Lucasfilm on developing really interesting schools programs, basically going into their sort of techie hovels, their little homes, and finding the people who are actually creating these amazing software codes and these amazing graphics that actually have been electrifying the world, and trying to find ways of making that work accessible to a larger public, and particularly a young one, to inspire them to maybe a life in film.
You're working with Milton Chen, who used to be here at KQED. In fact, you've got a grants program for filmmakers, Filmmaker 360 program, and lots of things that really appeal to the young and that take the young in terms of film education into account. And I think done some really yeoman work on that score. We're talking to Noah Cowan, who, by the way, is the new executive director of the San Francisco Film Society, which presents the San Francisco International Film Festival from April 24th to May 8th. And we will, of course, talk about that film festival, give you some highlights of it, and also take your calls, and any suggestions you have, I'm sure, would be welcome at this point. I've got to find out, though. I'm reading about Noah, as is my wont, before we have somebody on the air here, and they ask you, which is a typical question for a journalist to ask, what are your favorite films? And what an eclectic selection. In the Mood for Love, La Notte, Towering Inferno, which was done here in San Francisco.
Yep.
But Preston Sturges and the Palm Beach Story, you've seen 25 times. And Dan Zoll, our senior editor, turns out is a tremendous fan of that movie, too. Tell us, what is it that makes you so rhapsodic about that movie?
You know, I feel like I saw a lot of comedies in my life before I was shown the Palm Beach Story. And but I kind of feel as though that film always reminds me to laugh and teaches me how to laugh. It earns every moment of joy in the film, and brings me back to a sort of a simpler moment when cinema was still experimenting with how it could tell stories in clever and new ways. And I never ceased to find delight in it. And it was shown to me in a particular context, which I've passed on too. It was shown to me by someone who had just begun to date, and this was sort of their test to see whether I was worthy. And I believe I've used it similarly since, just to make sure my sense of humor aligns with a potential new partner. So it has a very particular personal flavor for me.
It's 1942 film with Claudette Colbert and Joel McRae, and I'm sure this is going to urge a lot of people to go out and see it, especially when you talk about all that. Well, I haven't seen it. I want to see it.
Oh, really?
It
it's a great film. And in fact, one of his other – Preston Sturges is the director. One of his other great films is actually in the spotlight at our festival this year, oddly enough. David Thompson, the legendary film historian and critic, is receiving our Mel Novikoff Award, and it's the film he chose to actually talk about his career in cinema. So the Preston Sturges is always bubbling at the surface of anyone interested in cinema, I think.
He also given an award, the Fine Director Award, Richard Linklater.
Another great cinephile.
Yeah. Tell me, though, I mean, well, let me broach a little more difficult question here, maybe a vexing question, maybe one that doesn't require any vexation at all, but there's been some rumors going around that there's financial concerns, and I'd like to just get that out in the open with you if I could.
Well, it's been – I mean, obviously, it's been a pretty crazy few years. There's been some tragedy that struck the organization and a lot of comings and goings. The good news through that entire period is that the programming team has remained very stable and has continued to create and grow amazing programs. So terrific festivals. As I mentioned before, we've been funding fantastic films through that whole time, and our education program continues to grow. The good news is, before I arrived, a lot of ground was tilled, and a lot of fundraising was done by our current board chair to create a real sense of stability around the organization. So, frankly, I'm walking into an organization that's doing just fine and is sort of ready for a spurt of growth.
And can you talk a little bit about this film, this new online community and toolkit you've got going?
Oh, FilmEd, it's great. I mean, we're in early stages right now, and we're looking for partners. So if anyone is hearing us out there who feels like supporting this, it's actually an online resource that allows a lot of the social action-oriented films that we've been supporting through the Film Society, films like Fruitvale, to actually get out to a wider classroom public. Teachers, as we know, are the hardest working people in the world these days and, you know, don't have time to do much at all except prepare for the next day's lesson. This provides the resources for them to actually use media in the classroom more effectively.
Again, our guest is Noah Cowan. He's executive director of the San Francisco Film Society, which presents the San Francisco International Film Festival each year, this year from April 24th to May 8th, and we are going to give you a preview. But in the meantime, let me give you the phone number, because I know there are many of you who have thoughts not only about the film festival, but about independent films, about San Francisco's film culture, about, well, the whole nature of selection of films by the film festival, and also just about film festivals in general. If you'd like to join us, we welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join the conversation with any questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, so join the program, 866-733-6786. You can also email in your thoughts or questions or comments, forum at kqed.org, or post any onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. And for more about the San Francisco International Film Festival, visit kqed.org/arts. In the meantime, let's visit what's coming up in this year's film festival. There's a film that's already gotten a lot of attention. I think it was at it was at Sunset. Yeah, and it has to do with employment in North Dakota. It's called The Overnighters.
Yeah,
The Overnighters. Excuse me. It's got a whole. Well, let's hear a clip from it. Actually, I think we have a clip from it. I think, Danny, don't we? Let's hear.
There's no jobs. Indiana has an unemployment rate for high school diploma, no college, of like 26%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really bad. And so I tried to get a job. I couldn't get a job. And so I read an article, said there's boatloads of work in North Dakota. Boatloads. My dad said, well, I can get some money from grandma, and I'll loan you some, and I'll get you a one-way ticket there, you know? And it's been trial after trial, and I'm just at the end of my rope.
Boy, well, it's a powerful excerpt. All those people going up there for work, and there's a guy at the end of his rope. Tell us a bit about this film. It's a local filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the films that we supported, not through our Kenneth Rainin Fund, but through a different fund in our documentary section, the Generosity Foundation. And we're so proud of it. It won the...
we're proud of the Generosity Foundation, too. They fund us.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, we can sort of share our joy. The film actually won a prize in Sundance. I don't think they gave it away before, called a Special Jury Award for Intuitive Filmmaking. And it actually sort of speaks to what makes this film really special. The clip that we heard, it's sad. It's quite beautiful. Some of how these guys sort of confess how they got to South Dakota. But what this is a classic example of what should be a dry, boring topic, mass migration of labor to an area where the fracking is the, sort of the new industry.
Is it South Dakota or North Dakota?
I think it's South Dakota, isn't it?
Is it?
And North Dakota. My apologies. And we are immersed immediately in this quite extraordinary life of this pastor, this guy who's become this sort of new great hostel creator, and his church becomes this place where really a mosaic of contemporary America finds itself, of poor America finds itself. And finds their dreams sometimes uplifted, mostly dashed, and how that plays out in a lot of new contemporary issues. Unfortunately, this is the worst part of being a film programmer because we see them in advance. This also has a twist worthy of The Good Wife, at the end of it, in terms of the motives of the various people involved in the film. So you actually leave it with a real sense of filmmaking as well as the story and the issues around it.
Should mention, by the way, just as a kind of footnote here, an important footnote, though, much of your experience and much of your expertise is in Asian films, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah, for various reasons, mostly because that was where the action was. When I began in the 1990s, I spent a lot of time in both India and China and Japan in between, trying to document and show some great films from the movements that were bubbling up in all of those places.
You like that Yamagata Film Festival in Japan?
It's fantastic. It's another one of those models, I think, that San Francisco can learn something from. Just a kind of a gentleness and an attention to detail about each and every screening that they do.
Let's hear another cut from, and this is from a movie that will be part of the film festival, San Francisco International Film Festival, a movie called Ping Pong Summer.
What's up, space dork? I heard from a little birdie that after we left the fun hub, you were eating crab au gratin with Stacy. But that couldn't have been you, right? I mean, she only dates white people.
Give it back.
What? This? I mean, I'm thirsty. Milk does a body good, right?
Does your body good.
Stop, Lyle!
Stop, Lyle!
You know, you do look pretty dehydrated.
Oh, gross!
Back off!
That's a scene from the film Ping Pong Summer, and you can hear the bullies pouring milk all over the main character in that clip and the woman yelling, back off. It's actually Susan Sarandon coming to the boy's rescue. That'll play May 4th at 6:30 at the Kabuki Theater and on May 7th at 8:45 at the New People's Cinema. And let's talk also about Overnighters, which you heard a clip from. It'll be playing April 28th at 6:30 at the Kabuki and May 3rd at 1 o'clock at the New People's Cinema. And these are two kind of showcase movies for you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Ping Pong Summer is, of course, the other end of the spectrum from Overnighters, a very serious film, very serious topics. Ping Pong Summer is just great fun, and I think points to a new talent, someone who's able to actually talk about sort of how we interact with one another today, and the fun in contemporary life in that respect.
It's a coming of age story, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think you're going to see great things from director Michael Tully in the future.
And let's bring our callers in, and we'll begin, Jonathan, with you. Good morning.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A number of years ago, the Film Society took over the San Francisco Film Arts Foundation with the intention of holding up their mandate to really support local filmmakers, to offer filmmaker services. The Film Arts Foundation, they offered equipment rentals, they offered editing facilities, they had great library, they had a job data bank for filmmakers, they had a really wonderful magazine called Release Print that had all the updates on what was going on in Bay Area filmmaking. And I'm wondering what the plans are for the Film Society to follow in those footsteps.
Yeah, Noah Cowan.
Yeah, great question. I'm new to the job, and so I'm a little vague on the details, but my understanding was that when the great Film Arts Foundation, which has been so supportive to filmmakers here in the Bay Area, folded, we were able to take a piece of the organization, and then other pieces were dispersed in other places, some to their partners in the complex where they were housed, and some to BAVAC, I believe, also, which I think is now responsible for many of the services that you mentioned, Jonathan. We were really responsible for the sort of film support piece of filmmaker services, the funding part, the sort of helping those filmmakers actually find their way in the world of cinema, and also the educational component of the Film Arts Foundation. And those are the areas that we've been growing. We also took on sort of the Film Arts Festival, which now occurs in the fall under the name of the Cinema by the Bay, which, of course, will be coming back this year and will be celebrating the sort of the range and diversity of Bay Area-made cinema.
Now, since you were up in Canada, I'm sure you were well aware that a lot of filmmakers were going up there because of the taxes and the difficulties here in the Colossus to the south of Canada. Is there, in your mind, any kind of notion about how, I mean, Stephanie Coyote used to be essentially a person, Peter Coyote's wife, in charge of trying to make San Francisco a hub and be a magnet for filmmakers to come here and actually make films. She had Robert Redford call in one day, you know, and complained about the difficulty of making films here. Any thoughts about how we can make San Francisco more of a magnet?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the purposes of the San Francisco Film Society Kenneth Rainin Fund initiatives, is that we actually are taking filmmakers like Michael Tully, you heard the Ping Pong Summer clip, bringing them to San Francisco to experience, you know, filmmaking within a Bay Area context, so that they're either housed here for a few months as they're writing and developing, they're using Bay Area talent to actually make their films, and in many cases shooting here. We'll continue to make that a condition of the grant and try and expand that granting pool so that we can bring more and more filmmakers here and encourage them to stay. Once you have a critical mass, once you have a filmmaking community, I think organically the rest follows in its wake. And sort of building that is one of our goals.
Well, as you can hear, San Francisco Film Society's new leader has big plans, and we'll take more of your calls when we return. Best way to join us by phone is 866-733-6786. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle at KQED Forum, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. More of your calls and emails, web sub postings, and more with Noah Cowan when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Noah Cowan. Noah Cowan was named executive director of the San Francisco Film Society just a mere 2 months before the organization's biggest event, the San Francisco International Film Festival, which starts next week. And he comes to the organization after serving as artistic director of the Toronto International Film Festival and is the group's fourth executive director in 3 years. We're talking with him about the festival, about what's coming up in it, and all kinds of things related to the world of film. We should mention just a few more things in terms of the festival itself. I was looking at the roster of films. You got Nick Cave's 20,000 Days on Earth. What is that?
It's pretty crazy. I mean, I wouldn't call it experimental, but it's definitely comes from the mind of Nick Cave in a documentary about the act of creating music.
The Mind in the Cave. Well, that's something to reckon with in itself. You got also a 52 Tuesdays film all about sex change. Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the great goals of the San Francisco Film Society and the festival as well is we're trying to provide a global perspective. What's going on around the planet? And some of the stories that we find around the world are, I think, some of the most interesting ways of actually getting into understanding a society as a whole.
Yeah, talk a little bit. We're going to go to calls here and emails, but about this movie White Shadow about albino. Again, very unusual story.
Well, it's sort of Africa Day, I guess, here on,
yeah,
on the forum.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a long tradition of albinos both being these sort of spiritual forces that are revered in Africa and also outcasts. And it's sort of perceived in these very different ways. And this film really takes a kind of poetic look at that and shows you sort of the both sides of that within the narrative of basically an average everyday teenager in Africa and how he's sort of affected by either being seen as a god or being seen as a demon.
Some online remarks. A listener says, The Unknown Known, the 2013 Errol Morris documentary that I alluded to about Donald Rumsfeld, is available on Amazon Prime. Streaming is convenient and pauses, closed caption and replays. Thank you for that. That's good to know. Shelley says, I've heard that Noah Cohen has a 12-year-old Great Dane who has moved with him to San Francisco. I'd like to know how his dog is adjusting to San Francisco living and his secret for keeping his Dane in good health at the ripe old age of 12. That's extraordinary. And indeed, it is a Dane. Yeah,
yeah, well, it would be if it was a Great Dane. This was actually a misquote from the Chronicle when I came down here. It's still impressive, but maybe a little less so. It's actually a greyhound, and he's adorable. He's a gray brindle greyhound, and he's actually going to be joining me towards the end of the summer now as I become more settled here.
12-year-old Danes are very unusual.
That's really rare. 12-year-old greyhounds aren't quite as unusual, but still, it's a ripe old age.
And Bernese Mountain Dogs, I don't think I've ever heard of one living to that age of 12. A listener writes, it's good to see that mainstream theaters are showing some of the foreign movies, such as from India. Good news is that you have access to more foreign movies. Bad news, as many times these movies are populist, but not always represent the best movies.
It's not a bad comment. It's really funny. I mean, I think that there's been a sort of a change in viewership, and maybe while there's still a sense of curiosity about films coming out, people also don't gravitate to downers. You know, we don't have to go to the movies anymore. There's television, there's the internet. And so when people actually make the trek to go to a movie, I think they want something that's going to be somewhat uplifting. That's part of the purpose of film festivals, where people will actually take more of a chance on something that might be a bit more challenging.
You get to see like first-run movies. I mean, you have to see so many movies that you're screening and vetting and everything. I just wonder. It's like people say to me, do you read thrillers? I said, maybe on a vacation, but who the hell has time? You know, preparing for classes and reading for the work I do here on the air. Do you have time to go to the regular?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're a longtime film programmer, you tend to be able to use some shorthand, so you know very quickly whether it's something that's going to be of interest for you if you're not professionally related to it. So if you see a guy getting up and leaving a commercial film after 40 minutes, it's probably me.
Did you see the new Wes Anderson film, The Budapest Hotel?
I saw that actually in a film festival. It premiered earlier in the year, and it's there's a great deal of delight to be had.
It's entertaining.
In that film.
Yeah, it was entertaining. Let me go to more calls. Gary joins us. Hi, Gary.
Yes, one of the greatest film experiences I think I ever had was seeing Abel Gance's Napoleon several years ago at the Silent Film Festival.
Yeah, we did a whole segment on it. In fact,
wonderful, just wonderful. And I was wondering, is there any chance in the future that a great silent film will be shown at the San Francisco Film Festival?
How fantastic you've asked that question, because in fact, we actually try to do some sort of music on film presentation every year. It's actually one of the sort of signature elements of the festival and part of our international reputation. This year, I think the really interesting event that's going to be around that topic is Stephen Merritt from Magnetic Fields has actually composed a new score to Todd Browning's The Unknown. So,
and then Napoleon film, by the way, for anybody who has an opportunity to see it, is really extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, Napoleon is a pretty incredible thing because it's a three-screen presentation and so requires weeks and weeks of setup.
And the music, too.
And the music as well. It's had multiple wonderful scores, including a new one, I think, that was composed in this region. But, yeah, if you get a chance to see it, it's a real masterpiece.
And thank you, Gary. And another caller joins us. It's Neil. Good morning.
Yeah, I was wondering if you ever thought of acquiring one of those old theaters that have been closing, like the Bridge on Geary or the Lumiere, and using it as a permanent venue, permanent showcase for whatever movies you want to show. I know you have something a little bit like this in Japantown, but one of those other theaters that I mentioned might be a little more accessible. Another thing is, do you have any remarks on the death of the film critic Stanley Kaufman? Did you think much of him?
I mean, whatever your position on Stanley Kaufman's work is, I mean, he's a major figure in our field.
I read him religiously when I used to read the New Republic every week.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm actually a fan, but anyone in our field, anyone who's studied film, you have to pay attention to him and the pathway that he burned for the rest of us. On the theater front, you know, I think that we need to be very clear about what our goals would be with such a venue. There, you know, while San Francisco has been losing some of its older theaters. Actually, this city is in better shape than most others in America.
Actually, forgive me, looking at an online comment here from Chris, who says, I've always loved the movies. I was so disappointed when the old movie theater on Union Street between Webster and Buchanan was being converted into a gym.
No, so it's funny. It's happening here. It's happening a little later. I think a lot of these conversions happened in the 80s and 90s in New York City, which lost virtually all of its downtown theaters. The Angelica Film Center essentially wiped them all out. Bleecker Street, you name it. While that process is happening here, it's happening more slowly, and there's wonderful organizations which we have nothing to do with, like the Neighborhood Film Project, which are actively seeking to create land trusts around these theaters and ensure that there's programming. I think our goal for the short term, to the caller, is to partner with some of these organizations and partner with some of these independents to ensure their survival, as opposed to us recreating our own venue that then is going to be in competition with these theaters that are really neighborhood anchors here. And I think remain. I mean, I was just at the Vogue the other day, and there's something different about that neighborhood because it has a theater in it.
We also have in San Francisco major and quite talented filmmakers, with extraordinary bodies of work. I'm thinking about my friend Phil Kaufman. That's my own bias, but I'm also thinking about people like Chris Columbus, who's here, and Coppola, who's here, and the list just goes on.
I mean, some of the greatest filmmakers working, and some of the most successful as well. It's wonderful, but there's also a lot of room, I think, for independent filmmakers, independent thought. There's also an extraordinary group of documentary filmmakers here in San Francisco, and the Bay Area is still very much regarded as a home, kind of a crucible for actually social action documentary.
As long as they can afford to live here. Here's Zach as our next caller. Zach, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious if the new economic reality of the Bay Area, how expensive it's become, makes it difficult for filmmakers.
Zach, it's difficult to hear you. Are you speaking through a megaphone?
Okay, is it better now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, sorry about that. So I'm curious if the new economic reality of the Bay Area makes it difficult for filmmakers to find actors, given how expensive it is here now.
So just for readers who didn't, the listeners who didn't hear, it was really, do the economic realities of San Francisco make it difficult for filmmakers to find actors? The good news is that the rest of the Bay Area has actually been able to accommodate a lot of talent and a lot of crew members, as the economic realities of central San Francisco have changed. One of the goals of our organization is to ensure that these people are constantly working. So that's why the funding mechanisms we have actually encourage the utilization of crews, of technical companies in the area, as well as these what we call above-the-line talent, writers, actors, directors.
Let me thank you for that question. We'll go to more of your calls in just a moment. By the way, if you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. We gave a little clip from The Overnighters, and we mentioned White Shadow, a film about albino. And these were both, I believe, at Sundance. What's your relationship with Sundance?
They're great. I mean, Sundance really created the modern model of how we're going to support filmmakers in the future. There are labs, Sundance Institute, which is the parent of the Sundance Film Festival, and was begun beforehand by Robert Redford, created a framework which, I think we've in part taken on, although we're doing things in a somewhat different way. To actually provide a sort of stability, a home, ongoing training, and inspiration for the filmmaking community. And the festival is really more and more, I think, an extension of that. I went through a period which I think it was very consumed with sales and the marketing of films and movie stars, and it's really come back to its roots under its new leadership to sort of champion the plucky independent, the person making films for, you know, $50,000 with a credit card. And that's great to see. And from our perspective, Sundance is a partner in a lot of the films that we fund and also a source of many of the films that we think are going to inspire Bay Area audiences.
Well, one other local thing that comes to mind is a movie called Palo Alto. James Franco put together from his short story, which was, I guess, titled after his hometown, from the whole volume and so forth. You know anything about that movie?
Absolutely. That's the centerpiece of our festival this year. Obviously, it's made – Franco is, of course, a sort of a local superstar and a global superstar these days. But there's another star family that's involved with it as well, Gia Coppola, who's Francis Ford Coppola's granddaughter. And Sophia's niece.
Ah.
And so Gia's amazing and extremely talented and has gone back in many ways to one of her grandfather's obsessions, which is the complications of teen life. He, of course, addressed it famously in The Outsiders and Rumblefish.
And that New York Stories.
And New York Stories, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And this one, this film is more contemporary. Of course, it's Franco's book, so it's more in our contemporary time. And because it's Franco, it's also a little creepier. But she has such a grace, such a power in her direction that you actually feel the lives of these young characters no matter how old you are, much like her grandfather did with his films.
How many films do you go through in a year? Do you know?
Thousands.
Because I know. I remember when Peter Scarlett, way back when, was head of the – he said the same thing. Thousands.
Thousands. I mean, we see them. We try to see really pay attention to the filmmakers and films that we know are coming through exciting provenances, whether producers that we know or sellers or other festivals. But we also get, you know, lots and lots of submissions, and we take them all very, very seriously. You know, our blind submission process actually yields 3 or 4 films in the festival every year, which is actually quite a high ratio, believe it or not, compared to others. But yeah, no, we try and see as much as possible. Of course, the numbers have grown a great deal since the digital revolution, since it became much easier and much cheaper to make films. But it's also provided us opportunities to even explore more regional filmmaking tendencies, other global tendencies that in countries where they might not have been able to afford to make a film before. For example, we're showing the first feature film that we know of to be produced by Costa Ricans in Costa Rica this year.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Noah Cowan. He's the executive director of the San Francisco Film Festival. I almost said the new executive. When are you going to drop that new? When are people going to just get – I mean, it's been well, you're still in the honeymoon phase. That's
exactly
good.
I'll be the belle of the ball through this festival, and then hopefully everyone will be sick of me.
But you got a question here that – well, David asks, how do you justify $15 a ticket?
Because we provide a very different kind of experience. Putting on a film festival isn't the cheapest thing in the world. It's pretty close, frankly, to what it costs to go see movies these days that are, I think are half the quality of what we're actually bringing in at expense, including the directors in many cases as well. We also believe that becoming part of a film festival is becoming part of a film society, that we're offering an opportunity to commune with fellow cinephiles. And while I would love to find a donor who'd love to subsidize our tickets and, you know, make this an even more accessible opportunity, I challenge you to find another cultural activity, you know, bringing in this much international talent at this price. The performing arts and the arts in cinemas and in cinemas is just pricey.
Here's Navgar, our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, welcome.
So I'm calling because you mentioned that it's hard to get independent movies online, and I've actually been going to a site called Mubi.com, M-U-B-I-B, like boy.
Yeah, they're great.
And they're amazing. You can get a different independent movie each day. They have online festivals. There was one on the Mexican Revolution recently for the centennial anniversary of the revolution. And I find that I'm getting movies there that I otherwise just wouldn't hear about.
Yeah,
so I just wanted to share that with everyone.
Yeah, their specialization is actually in historical cinema, and they have some of the most interesting film critics actually writing on their site as well. So when you're actually looking at films, you actually get decent critical writing. I think one of the problems
Charge.
With the, There's a charge.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the problems with the Amazons and iTunes is, yeah, this movie looks interesting, but you're not actually getting someone of sort of intelligence and perspective maybe giving you the context that the film was created in.
Thank you for that. Good to hear from you. We hear next from William in Alameda. William, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to know if you guys had seen the film Siete Cajas from Paraguay. I think it was released maybe 2 years ago, but I know it did some rounds in some festivals. It couldn't be admitted into the Oscars because Paraguay doesn't have a film commission. Some friends of mine actually made the film, so I was curious if he had seen it. It seems to have been very well regarded in the film industry. But
Can you tell me the title of the film again?
Siete Cajas.
Siete Cajas. I have not personally seen it. It's very possible the team here has.
Okay.
Thank you for
all
that.
Right. Thank you.
I mean, this has been an international film festival right from the get-go 57 years ago. How much do you have to take into perspective, you know, the diversity, the range, different continents, all that sort of thing?
It's absolutely the greatest pleasure of the job. I mean, we're sort of constantly combing through, okay, what is the next Costa Rica? Who else is going to start producing films or starting producing films again? I think one of the joys for me, having been to the country a couple of times, was when Sri Lanka's civil war ended, this robust film industry that used to be there sort of reemerged and with some terrific films. So we're always sort of looking out in the world and seeing what's happening and hoping to bring those trends back here to the Bay Area.
And let's bring another caller on, and that's you, Peter. Welcome. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. And I was very interested to hear that the Society funds movie making. I was completely unaware of that. And I am aware, in fact, I have a personal friend who is a survivor of the atomic bomb at Hiroshima. Takashi Tanimori lives right here in Berkeley, and he was 8 years old and only, I think, within a mile of the epicenter. It was a miracle that he survived. And his story of suffering and coming to the United States, suffering much more here, but eventually triumphing, and also his catharsis and choice for forgiveness is really compelling. We have a summary of that story at a nonprofit website that I promote called staralliance.org on the people page.
Peter, are you asking a question here? Forgive
me. My question is, how do you go about if you have a kind of hot story like this for the 70th anniversary coming up in August 2015? But you don't know where to start and how to get going. Can the society help, and how does one apply?
So it's a very moving story, Peter, and thanks for bringing it to our attention. We're actually the second phase of that. So the first phase is to find a director and producer who would be interested in this story. Of course, there's some of the best documentary makers, producers, some TV stations actually here that specialize in this sort of thing. The Independent Lens folks are, you know, particularly strong on such stories. And I would actually just start approaching people that you think might be interested in telling your story on screen. Once one of them gets excited, then the application form is on our website.
Thank you, Peter. And here's a tweet from Mike along similar lines, and we've discussed this a bit already, but he wants to know, how can local Bay Area actors, directors, writers, and filmmakers get involved in the San Francisco independent film scene?
Make yourselves aware to us, to others. Come out to film events. There are, as we've been talking about, there are a lot of different film festivals and film-related events happening in the Bay Area. Some of them are more prominent than others, but there are always filmmakers present. So if you actually want to get involved in making movies, come out to the San Francisco International Film Festival and come out to the Bay Area-produced films. Go to our friends at Frameline or CAM or many of the other great festivals which encourage Bay Area filmmaking and start speaking to the directors, casting agents, and producers who actually show up at these screenings and are delighted usually to talk to local people who want to get involved.
Here's Joe, who writes, I'm wondering if there's anywhere we can find out which films will be getting distribution. I'm asking this because I like to spend my time and money at the film festival on seeing films I'm not going to get a chance to see anywhere else, and I like to save some films to see at theaters throughout the year.
It's a great question and a very complicated one for us because the way that the film business operates is still a bit Byzantine, and so films which we select and put in our guide which don't have distribution will often secure it around the time of the festival, and we don't have any way of actually telling you that. In other cases, it's obvious. So, for example, our opening night film, which has big movie stars in it, it's called Two Faces of January, and sort of Viggo Mortensen and Kirsten Dunst. I mean, that is absolutely going to theaters, and there's trailers around.
Who directed that?
A wonderful guy called Hossein Amiri, and he's actually going to be here. He's a terrific screenwriter. He wrote, I don't know if you saw Drive, the film by Nicholas Refn with Ryan Gosling. Fantastic film from a couple years ago. He wrote that, and this is his actual feature film debut. But it's a big, sweeping epic based on Patricia Highsmith novel, like The Talented Mr. Ripley,
yeah.
A sort of a thriller between character-driven thriller. Wonderful film. And, you know, he's going to be here with us. But, yeah, that's the kind of movie that you can pretty assured is going to be in the theaters. For some of the other ones, for example, our closing night film, The Alex of Venice, which, you know, is directed by a star, Chris Messina, stars Don Johnson. It doesn't have a distributor yet. My sense is after it comes to this festival, it probably will.
Don Johnson, resurrected, huh?
He is fantastic in this movie. It's one of the revelations of the year for me, this, you know, actor from 80s TV.
He also lived here for many years.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
He was making San Francisco.
Great, but he's terrific in the film.
There are other films you got. Let's just talk about a few more of the films you're going to be featuring. One is called Alive Inside.
Mm-hmm.
This is a music film?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the Elliott Smith picture. And, you know, an amazing, amazing musician. And this really goes inside of his life and people who've actually recorded footage of him and what he's been able to do.
And what's
what he was able to do.
What's Two Girls, One Cake?
You know, I have to tell you, I have not seen Two Girls and One Cake yet. But of course, the title is pretty astonishing. I think that's in our shorts program, if I'm not mistaken.
It's in your program. Yeah. Maybe in the shorts program. Yeah. But here's Robert, who writes online. We mentioned earlier Preston Sturges' film, which he directed, The Palm Beach Story, which our guest has seen no less than 25 times. Robert writes, my nephew began referring to himself as a cinephile without ever having seen a Preston Sturges movie. I gently introduced him to The Lady Eve and Sullivan's Travels. Luckily, he wasn't insulted and instead became an enthusiast. Recently, in the late evening, I've been watching and rewatching the beautiful Criterion Collection edition of Preminger's Anatomy of a Murder. After 15 viewings, I still see something new in it each time.
I mean, one of the benefits of the digital revolution has been this opportunity for all of us, not just film professionals, to rewatch films over and over again. And that provides this opportunity for media literacy. It actually allows us to see how films are made more exactingly. I mean, before, unless you actually didn't work and were able to sit in a movie theater all day for its week or two-week run, you usually got to see a movie one time. Maybe you'd revisit it again on television, one-time screening. And it's interesting. On my list of favorite films is a funny disaster movie from the 70s, which I adore, called The Towering Inferno. Part of the reason why it's on there is because my parents dumped me in Los Angeles with some friends when Z Channel was launched with The Towering Inferno. And so I actually, at a young age, I think I was 8 years old, I got to actually see the film a dozen times.
What a cast in that film.
Oh, incredible. And it's, by the way, I mean, I love it because it set the stage for so many genres, so many sort of interesting storytelling innovations, and of course the two greatest male movie stars of all time, you know, are in it. But so it's a great film. But it taught me how to look and read a film, and actually has provided a wonderful kind of bookmark for sort of future endeavors and future critical inquiries.
Well,
so I encourage everyone to do what your listener just wrote in about. Watch a movie a number of times. You'll start to see new things and start to see the craft of filmmaking. And with someone like Preminger, it's gorgeous to see how he changes things around, how he does things differently than other people.
I just have to ask you, this is always kind of a loaded question, but when you talk about looking and reading a film and talk about bookmarks, I know you're a reader, and there's always this ongoing debate, and it will probably never end, about whether you get more out of seeing a film and having all that visual in front of you, or reading a book and using your imagination and dealing with the text, maybe even Kindles now and all the other ways of reading books. But, you know, I must confess, as much as I love movies, I've always favored books, and this debate goes on, this argument goes on. You know, I mean, the book lovers versus the film lovers, and it's... There's a strange twist to it. I mean, the book lovers are a little bit snobbish, I think, in some ways about film.
I mean,
because it's an older medium.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a reader, and to an extent, I love to read. It's how I spend most of my spare time, and part of the joy of being in the Bay Area is actually being surrounded by many of my favorite writers. who are quite okay with you kind of emailing them about collaborative activity and things like that. It's great. So I've actually been having a wonderful time meeting people, and I hope to bring some of those literary figures into the festival in the future to do this and that.
You're going to give us some names?
I mean, for me, I love Rebecca Solnit's book on Muybridge. You know, it was really electrifying for me to have a writer go back and think about silent cinema in that way. Of course, Michael Chabon, I started reading as a young person. I've been following him ever since. And you have Dave Eggers here, who's sort of a incredible writer and chronicler of where we are and who we are. So I mean, and there's dozens and dozens more. Those are kind of the stars I know. But there you go. On the other side, though, your question is a good one, and I think one that's become even more acute as we have access to so many other technologies through the internet. We can sort of engage in any kind of artistic looking at art practice that we want. In a way, you can see every famous painting in the world online. You can read poetry. So how do we make decisions, and do we need to make decisions? And part of what I feel the role of film should be now, because it was the champion and the leader in 20th century culture, it was the biggest thing going, is that we can show a little humility and try to find the connections between movies and books, movies and food, movies and poetry, and find the ways that they actually intersect, and maybe use film to inspire passions in others that aren't necessarily cinema itself.
Well, I always tell my students, don't expect the movie to be the book. I mean, completely different form, really.
Yeah. I mean, some adaptations are fantastic and some are a little wanting. I find normally the adaptations I care for the least are ones that hew to the book most precisely.
Quick question from Sue in an email. Can your guest speak about the Emeryville-made, hand-drawn, beautifully painted animated short film called The Dam Keeper?
It's terrific that such talent is in the region, and I adore personally hand-drawn animation. I'd love to see more of it happening. I think I might have seen it, but I'm going to say that I haven't
film.
For now.
Yeah, it's a Pixar film, but when you see thousands, and those include short animated.
I've seen a number of the Pixar films, and I think they're really, really beautiful. I mean, one of the things about Pixar that's interesting and confusing is that they're such a prominent commercial company, but they pay such attention to detail of their audience and how they actually want their films to act. There's little as rich as actually going back to some of the Pixar films and actually rewatching them to sort of see exactly how their mechanisms of connection actually occur.
Noah Cowan, new executive director of the San Francisco Film Society, and the San Francisco Film Festival will run from April 24th to May. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. You can also continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum, or let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.